Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. The state of Mississippi certified their personhood amendment today. Big news, so congratulations to Personhood USA and everybody working for the right to life of the unborn down in Mississippi, which has now joined Colorado. Also, there is a book out in Europe, and it's on one of my favorite topics. And it's not available yet in the U.S. Now, years ago, I read a book called The Soul of Science by Piercy and Thaxton. What a fabulous book about the influence of Christianity on science, the natural sciences. And there's a new book out, God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science. Now, there's a U.S. edition that should be out early next year by Regnery, but we didn't want to wait that long, so we thought we would talk to the author, even though he's in England. Welcome to Bob Inyart Live in Colorado, James Hanam. Welcome to Bob Inyart Live.
Hiya, hello.
It's great to have you on the show, James.
Thank you very much indeed. It's great to be here.
So let's talk through your book, God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science. Some people call those days the Dark Ages, and they think of medieval as a very negative term, but your book tells a different story.
Yes, absolutely. My book tries to rehabilitate the Middle Ages and show that it was an important time when many central scientific achievements were made by people who were working in the universities, which were sponsored by the church.
Yeah, and this is going to be fascinating because, of course, we know the common interpretation is that Christianity was hostile to learning and to science in particular, and so that Christianity held back progress. And so,
I think that is something which many people believe, but in fact, historians for quite some time now have known that that's false, and that the common belief isn't true. And what I try to do is take what people who have done the academic research in the subject have known for some time, and write a book which ordinary people will be able to find interesting, which really simply explains for them what historians have known for quite some time, that science and religion haven't been in conflict, and that Christianity was an important ingredient in the rise of modern science, and that it was no accident that the scientific revolution took place in Christian Europe and not some other civilization.
Well, for example, in the East, where you have Eastern mysticism, they'll look at the universe and they'll refer to it as Maya or illusion.
That's right. That's one philosophy they have. They also have a philosophy that the universe is in a constant cycle and has existed forever, simply going round in circles, and that progress is, as a result, completely impossible. Whereas the Christian worldview is that at the beginning of time, God created the world, and that the universe is gradually going to the place that God wants it to go to, and consequently it's progressing over the centuries, and that means that human progress is possible, and it's possible that we're able to find out more and more things, and we're able to get a better and better idea of the universe.
We're speaking with James Hanam, the author of God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science. James, it's very easy to interview you, but I think I'd like to let the audience know that you are deaf and you hear through an implant.
And that's right. Yes, I have an electronic ear, And when it's turned off, which happens about once a day when the battery goes and I have to change it, I can't hear anything at all.
Oh.
It's an absolute miracle of science, of which I'm really, really grateful, because it's meant that I can hear again, I can talk to my children, which I wasn't able to do before, I can listen to music, which I wasn't able to do before. It's an absolutely fantastic blessing.
Well, congratulations for that, for enjoying that, and also for the awesome reviews that have been published, the Scotsman, the Spectator, in fact, the London Telegraph, the Sunday Telegraph, and the Sunday Times. You, and I'm not sure how you did it, James, but you got tremendous reviews. And
well, I was very pleased that the press here in England liked the book, because it shows that the book, although obviously Christians are pleased to hear that Christianity has been important for the rise of science, as far as the mainstream press here in England concerned, who aren't particularly Christian in their outlook, they've also received the book very positively, because what I'm saying is not simply something, a Christian message, is actually simply the truth of history.
Mm. So can I share a couple things that we've pointed out on this program over the last 20 years on Bob and Yurt Live on this topic, and you could either affirm or correct errors we might be making on the air?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, why don't you give us a time period of the six centuries that you report on? What period of time are they? Which centuries?
Well, the book really starts in 1000 AD, 1000 years after Christ, when a man who was the best mathematician in Europe, called Gerbert, became Pope Sylvester II. And it ends 650 years later with the death of Galileo.
Hmm. All right. And I used earlier the term Dark Ages, and quite often when we really study that period, we do find a very different history, including the influence of Christianity on learning. But let me ask you this. We've often said that the study of astronomy and cosmology, where the notion that the sun revolved around the earth and the planets revolved around the earth, that has been saddled on the back of the church. But in actuality, that was Greek. That was an Aristotelian cosmology that sadly the Christian church gave so much credibility to Aristotle that they taught that along with much of the rest of his philosophy and his worldview. But that's really Greek, pagan Greek. That's not really Christian.
I agree entirely. The influence of Aristotle was so great that for a long time people simply didn't question him properly. And what caused them to start to question him was during the 13th century, they realized that much of what Aristotle said was incompatible with Christianity. Of course, he wasn't a Christian, as you say, he was a pagan. And so the church said, look, you can't go around saying that Aristotle is absolutely correct about everything. Mm. You have to accept that he's sometimes wrong. And that began to cause the edifice of his philosophy to be chipped away. But unfortunately, as you say, his ideas that the sun goes round the earth took much, much longer to be discredited. But part of the reason for that was that it's not actually a really stupid thing to say that the sun goes round the earth.
Because it sort of looks like it does.
Exactly. And it's very difficult to prove the opposite.
Yeah, in fact, Aristotle would point out that, well, that the sun must be light because, look, it's floating, and we must not be moving because if you drop a rock, it falls straight down. It doesn't fall at an angle, which he thought that proved that we were not moving. Of course.
Exactly, and he thought that the fact that rocks had dropped down meant that we were at the center of the universe.
Yeah, and so along comes Isaac Newton from a Christian worldview. In fact, Copernicus, beginning to set the world straight that the earth revolves around the sun and the planets, and then Johann Kepler, Isaac Newton, Galileo, these were men that we're surrounded by Christian thoughts and a Christian worldview that corrected the Greek cosmology. But so Isaac Newton says, well, there's an addition of velocities, and because the rock is moving at the same speed as the Earth, it looks like it's falling straight down.
Exactly. And of course, we mustn't forget that Copernicus was a canon in his local cathedral. Kepler was a fantastically devout Christian who, when he was doing his science, would suddenly stop and jot down prayers in the margins of his book. And even Galileo, who, of course, got into unfortunate trouble with the Vatican, was a devout Christian who really wanted the church to see the truth.
And these men, of course, they're presented by the atheistic evolutionary world as enemies of Christian thought and enemies of, in fact, a biblical creator. But the truth is pretty much the opposite. These guys often, in fact, I put together a list myself, James, mm-hmm. of the fathers of the natural sciences who rejected a natural explanation of origins and who defended creation. And my list, I put it together chronologically before Darwin and after Darwin, and it's absolutely phenomenal to see the great names of the fathers of the natural sciences who defended creation before and after Darwin.
Yes, I think that's probably the case, although I have to admit that my personal views are what I think you call theistic evolution. All Christians have to be creationists, because all Christians have to say God created the universe.
Mm.
I think Christians disagree among themselves, and that's unfortunate, but it's the way it is, as to how God went about producing the variety of life that we see around us today.
Well, and
the idea that the universe simply popped into existence of its own accord is one that an atheist has to believe, and I frankly find completely ridiculous.
Well, because of the first and second laws of thermodynamics, a rock cannot make itself from nothing, and a fire cannot burn forever. So when the Eastern world thought the universe was always here, and the Bible said that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, then you come around to the 20th century, and pretty much the entire atheistic scientific world says, you know what? The Bible was right. The universe did have a beginning, as Stephen Hawking will point out. Otherwise, everything would be the same cold temperature.
Absolutely. The universe has to have a beginning. And it's fascinating that the first scientist to actually make the suggestion was a priest himself.
And who was
that?
The Big
Bang hypothesis was invented by a Jesuit priest.
Mm. And for me, I'm thankful, James, that you have stated clearly for us that you're a theistic evolutionist. Here on Bob and Yurt Live, we spent 20 years on the air debating evolutionists of all stripes, and perhaps we could do another show in the future about this issue. You believe in a creator, and you think maybe God used natural mechanisms to bring about various kinds of biological life and perhaps human beings.
I think he would be quite capable of creating a universe which is able to bring about that sort of variety.
That is certainly my
view.
Yeah, and so I don't know. It's a little rude of me to ask you on the air, but do you think you might enjoy doing a discussion on air of that in the future?
I'd enjoy that enormously. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, that'll be great. So then for now, we could get back to your book. And by the way, you will have a U.S. edition of God's Philosophers out?
Early next year, I hope, from Regnery. But for the moment, it is possible to buy the U.K. edition from the Conservative Book Club and the National Review. They've imported a few hundred copies, and I think there are still some going. But if you miss those, you'll have to wait another year.
All right. And why is it with today, in the age of the Internet and Amazon.com and all, James, you're an author, published author. Help us understand, why can't we just go on the Internet and buy the European edition?
Well, the reason for that is that, well, you can go on the internet and buy the European edition and get it shipped over. That's no problem.
So we're just paying for...
It will take quite a long time to be delivered. That's not something that is a problem.
Okay, so it might take 5 or 6 weeks and we're paying for international shipment.
Absolutely true.
But the
reason for getting a U.S. publisher regularly involved is that they know the American market. They can get publicity, they can make sure it gets into bookstores, which my UK publisher isn't able to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so could we perhaps talk through some of the details now that you go through in your book, trying to redeem at some level the medieval period, which some people call the Dark Ages. Did medieval people believe that the earth was flat?
Absolutely not. They were perfectly aware that the earth was a sphere. The idea that they all thought the world was flat is a Victorian invention, effectively. It appeared in a Victorian novel about Columbus, and the idea has just stuck in people's minds for some reason.
Well,
I seem to believe that people in the Middle Ages were ignorant. It's very unfortunate, but...
James, I seem to recall that if you go way back to maybe the time of Euripides or so, or Archimedes, that they would note when sunlight went directly down to the bottom of a well, and then there would be another well, what we might say 15 miles away, might be so many stadia away, and they would time to when the sunlight went to the bottom of that well, and they figured out, okay, a circle has 360 degrees, and so they would calculate the diameter of the earth, and they got it to within about 1,000 miles of the 24,000-mile circumference
that we have. That's right. There was somebody called Eratosthenes of Alexandria who did that experiment. So not only did people in the Middle Ages know that the earth wasn't flat, they actually knew how big it was. They knew to within, as you say, about 1,000 miles what its circumference was. So it's ridiculous to say that they thought that they lived on this sort of flat pancake.
Yeah, so that idea, and of course all these ideas, if they're pagan Greek ideas, the church gets saddled with the absurdity of it. If they're just fabricated mythology, the church gets saddled with it, so that people like, I don't know where we trace it, maybe Nietzsche, I would say, was one of the significant thinkers who sort of crystallized this war against the church and blamed the church for every error and for fabricated errors in scientific understanding.
Well, it's strange, isn't it, that when the pagan Greeks get something right, the pagan Greeks get credit for it. And when they get something wrong, and they got a lot wrong, then we blame the medieval church for continuing to believe that until, other Christians came along and said that it was wrong. And the whole way that history is portrayed is just completely unfair on people in the Middle Ages.
Well, how about this? I've heard it claimed that the church tried to ban the number zero. Of course, zero, when I think it was Arabs who introduced zero, and because when I learned my Roman numerals, there was no symbol for zero. So I don't think the Roman Empire, I don't recall that they had zero, but when zero was introduced, it helped science and math progress just to an extraordinary degree, and it was said that the church tried to ban zero at some point. Is that true?
That's not true, no. The church didn't try to ban zero, and it didn't try to ban Arabic numerals either. There was an occasion, and this is one of the funny stories about history, which means that I love the subject so much, that in one Italian city, merchants who are obviously very excited by the new mathematics for calculating their profits, they couldn't decide which symbols they should be using for each number. And so they kept on disagreeing as to whether a zero should be a circle or a dot or what a five should be. And the city council stepped in and it banned them from using Arabic numerals because they couldn't make their minds up. And it seems to be from that that we got the story that, that zero was banned. And it's incredible that even today, if you were to travel to the Middle East, you will find that the Arabic symbol that they use today for five is a circle. It's the symbol that we use for zero. So we inherited the numbers. We inherited the concept. But when we swapped all the numbers around because we couldn't tell which one was which.
Yeah, that is really interesting, and thanks for pointing that out. We, every few years, I head up a tour to a country where history of the Bible took place. So we've gone repeatedly to Israel, we've gone to Greece, Italy, Turkey, and in Turkey they have the Turkish number, which is 40. And it's sort of fascinating to look at the history of cultures in terms of their numbers and their mathematics. It's really revealing, and it's a lot of fun. Okay, so how about dissection, human dissection? Is that something that a pope once tried to ban?
No, he didn't. In fact, one of the earliest records we have of a human dissection taking place is the pope himself ordering that some plague victims be dissected to try and better understand the disease.
Was that in around the year 1000, the Black Plague?
That was during the Black Death. It was before the Black Death. In fact, that was during the 13th century. And the people who were objecting to human dissection, unsurprisingly, were the people, the criminals, in fact, who were being used as the subjects for dissection after they had been executed.
All right.
They could be, if they were particularly unlucky, handed over and used as subjects for dissection. People were not keen on this happening to them. It's very difficult to get bodies to do research and teaching on. It's quite a gory subject, and people are still quite squeamish about that sort of thing, understandably.
Yeah,
but it wasn't actually the church that was setting up the opposition. There was one occasion where a pope said that crusaders couldn't have their bodies boiled so that the flesh was rendered off the bones, and the bones could then be shipped home to be buried in the family tomb in Normandy or somewhere from where they had been campaigning around Jerusalem. And this seems to be the reason that people thought that, in the 19th century, people thought that the church banned human dissection. But the fact is, they didn't. And if the church had tried to ban human dissection, there's no doubt that human dissection would not have happened.
Well, that's a great point. And, of course, it is an issue with significant implications. Like today, for example, in China, the Chinese government will take executed criminals and use their organs. Livers can be transplanted after death with almost the same success rate as from a live donor, or a kidney, for example, a kidney. And so criminals in China are thinking, hey, wait a minute, there is a conflict of interest here. They're going to want to convict me because of all the money in my organs. So we can understand how criminals and those concerned generally with justice might not like the idea of using criminals for scientific experiments.
Certainly not unwillingly. I mean, today, if people who are used for scientific research after they're dead, they volunteer for that. And if people want to volunteer for that, that's fine by me. But it's wrong that it would be involuntary.
Yeah, I agree. So now we're almost out of time. We only have another couple minutes. How about inventions during the medieval period? Could you give us an idea what was going on with technology?
Well, in the field of technology, the Middle Ages was a period of fantastic inventiveness. People seem to think that everything stood still, but the opposite is the case. And particularly in the field of agriculture, they brought in new ideas about crop rotation, new ideas about using a heavy plow, about using horses, mechanics, invented the most fantastic invention, the mechanical clock, which is like the foundation for
machinery. So the clock, do you recall what century that was that the clock was invented?
That the clock was probably invented around about 1300 in Italy.
Wow.
And before that time they had water clocks, but nobody had a mechanical clock, a clock you could like wind up and it would go. And this was it was an amazing invention.
Wow, and how about eyeglasses?
That's another fantastic invention, of course, because it meant that people, and that was invented probably in Florence or in Pisa, around about 1320, I think. And that was a fantastic invention because it meant that the working lives of scholars whose eyesight was failing was suddenly extended for 20 years.
Mm.
And some historians have said that this was fantastically important because the wisdom and learning, of course, of people increases as they get older. But if they suddenly can't read...
Right, if they can't see, right, exactly. And in fact, in our country, James Hannum, we have a retirement that sort of tells people, once you're 60, 65, we don't really need you any longer. And we're losing a lot of tremendous wisdom and experience just because of this modern cultural idea that we got to toss you out the front door when you're still perfectly capable and wise for working.
Well, one thing I will say for the Romans is they had rules that you had to reach a certain age before you were allowed to be a senator or before you were allowed to be a consul. And I think that was quite sensible. They thought that you had to reach a certain experience before you could do those jobs. It might be a rule that we could possibly bring in again.
All right. Well, James Hannum, thank you so much. Your book, God's Philosophers. Yes, God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science. James, if it's all right, my producer will contact you and we'll schedule another interview.
Thank you very much indeed. I look forward to it.
All right. I appreciate that from across the Atlantic. The book, again, God's Philosophers, and you could get it if you pay for the shipping. And in fact, if you contact the Conservative Book Club, you can get James' book, and I'm sure it's a fascinating read. As I said at the beginning of the show, a long time ago, I read a book called The Soul of Science by Thaxton and Piercy. What a great, great book. One of probably my top 10 most favorite books of my life, The Soul of Science. Now, James' book looks like it's going to make a short list of great books, and we'll have him back on to debate theistic evolution. Boy, that'll be a lot of fun. This is Bob Enyart. Our website is kgov.com. Congratulations, Personhood USA, for getting on the ballot in Mississippi, and Maranatha, what a great school.